You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Welcome to the Open Society Foundations. My name is Jerry Fowler, and I am a senior policy analyst in the D.C. office of OSF, where I work on multilateral affairs and also on Asia issues, particularly regarding Burma and Southeast Asia. And one thing that we're very excited about in the Open Society Foundations is that work that we've been doing in a number of countries in Asia, including Burma, Indonesia, Nepal, and other countries, to promote tolerant and vibrant democracies, is being consolidated in an Asia regional office. And we have our first regional director for Asia, Binayfer Nowroji, who's been with OSF for many years as the director of our Open Society Initiative for East Africa. And today's event, I think, is being brought, at least in part, by the Asia Regional Office. And in that regard, I should thank Britton Alfred, who's the program coordinator for the Asia Regional Office, who has been instrumental in pulling everyone together. Well, we're here to talk about the vetting of UN peacekeepers. And I think, as everyone in this audience knows, UN peacekeeping has a long history, and it has become a bigger and bigger issue in the course of the last 20 years or so. Peacekeeping efforts started shortly after the creation of the United Nations in 1948 with the creation of the UN Truce Supervision Organization, which was deployed to the Middle East, and with the UN Military Observer Group in India and Pakistan, which was deployed to India and Pakistan. The first armed deployment, those were unarmed observers, the first armed deployment was in 1956 to the Sinai Peninsula, and the first really large-scale complex deployment was beginning in 1960 in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Since the first mission in 1948, there have been 69 UN peacekeeping missions, and 56 of those, 81%, have been since 1988. Currently, there are 16 peacekeeping missions and then a political mission that DPKO is responsible for running in Afghanistan, and more than 100,000 personnel are deployed across those missions. For the year that just ended on the 30th of June, there was a budget of $7.83 billion for the for peacekeeping. As I'm sure everyone in this audience knows, missions since the end of the Cold War have grown increasingly complex, and many of them have a civilian protection component. Nine of the current missions include civilian protection in their mandate, and that involves 95% of deployed personnel. And as you know, the missions that have the civilian protection component are the ones that are in the most challenging environments as well, such as South Sudan, Central African Republic. So this raises an important question. How are troops selected for these missions? In particular, what is their record regarding interactions, the record of the troops before they're selected, regarding their interactions with civilians and with respecting human rights? At the end of 2012, the Secretary General issued a new policy on the human rights screening of UN personnel. But so far as we know, the reports that will be discussed today, and I should say that will be available in hard copy at the end of the program, are the first ever studies from the field as to how UN peacekeepers are selected by their national governments. Studies and reports done previously by the UN and others, such as the report prepared in 2004-2005 by the now incoming High Commissioner for Human Rights, Jordanian Ambassador Zayed Raad Zayed Al Hussein, have generally focused on sexual abuses perpetrated by the peacekeepers while part of a peacekeeping mission, and of course, accountability issues related to such abuses. These reports, which address Nepal, India, Bangladesh, and Nigeria, go beyond these issues and start with the selection in the context of the national background and the lack of accountability for abuses that have been committed there. In this way, we hope that these reports will contribute to a broadening of the discussion of the imperatives of civilian protection, respect for human rights, and accountability for human rights abuses. The four countries that I mentioned, of course, are among the top troop contributing nations. I think they're four of the top seven troop contributing nations. So their processes and policies with regard to troop selection are vitally important in terms of what happens on the ground once missions are deployed. To present the reports, we're privileged and fortunate today to have the authors and experts on the issue. I'll start to my left with Mandira Sharma. She's a leading human rights activist from Nepal and the founder of both the Advocacy Forum Nepal and the Accountability Watch Committee. Both organizations work to promote human rights and rule of law in Nepal and to contest impunity. She also serves as an advisor to the Alliance for Social Dialogue Nepal, which is a key partner of the Open Society Foundations. She's been a leading voice in Nepal on the issue of torture, extrajudicial killings, and forced disappearances, sexual abuse, and impunity related to those crimes. She is a recipient of the Human Rights Defenders Award, which is the highest honor given by Human Rights Watch for her struggle to promote human rights in Nepal. To my right is Suhas Chakma, who is a leading Indian human rights defender and the director of the Asian Center for Human Rights. In that capacity, he supervised the overall project and specifically directed the reports on India and Bangladesh. He serves as a member of the NGO core group that advises India's National Human Rights Commission on human rights issues, and he previously served as the interlocutor between the Ministry of Home Affairs of the Government of India and the Mizoram Bru Displaced Peoples Forum to facilitate the repatriation of the Brus. And then to my far left is Awal Ibrahim Musa from Nigeria. He's a human rights, anti-corruption policy and legislative advocacy advocate who works for positive transformation in Nigeria and in Africa. He's currently the executive director of the Civil Society Legislative Advocacy Center and the chairman of the Zero Corruption Coalition, as well as Nigeria coordinator of the West African Civil Society Forum and a member of Publish What You Pay Nigeria. One other person I should acknowledge who's been very instrumental in these reports is Ingrid Massaj, who is a senior advisor with Amnesty International and also works as an advisor to the Advocacy Forum in Nepal. So, Ingrid, welcome. Without further ado, we will proceed to the reports. The first one up will be Mandira, presenting the report on Nepal.
Thank you, Jerry. Good morning, everyone. You know, we are here from four major troop contributing countries to the UN peacekeeping missions. Lately, there has been discussions on establishing accountability and preventing human rights violations during the missions. We are here looking at the different countries' selection procedures for the peacekeepers with an attempt to really prevent human rights violations during the missions, not only during the missions, how we really contribute in preventing human rights violations on the ground if we really look into the backgrounds of the peacekeepers. Nepal is one of the major troop contributing countries. I think it stands seventh positions in the list of the troop contributing countries to the UN peacekeepings. We started contributing to the peacekeeping since 1958. Nepal has been regarded, Nepalese peacekeepers have been regarded as the professional peacekeepers. And in commemorating the 50th kind of contributions of Nepal's peacekeepings, the Secretary General of the UN commented that Nepalese peacekeepers are the shining examples. So this is the pride for the nation and prestige for those who are involved, and economically, I think, incentives for those who serve as the peacekeepers and the institutions that send the troops to the UN peacekeeping missions. We realize the peacekeeping being an effective and very important leverage in preventing human rights violations on the ground back in 2004, since 2004, I would say. When then UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Louis Arbour, who was visiting the country in Nepal, first raised that there will be consequences for soldiers or security personnel in peacekeeping if they are found to be involved in serious human rights violations. You know, that reference contributed significantly in reducing the ongoing violations of human rights violations in Nepal. We went through this 10 years long arms insurgencies, 1996 to 2006. 2000, you know, it really became very difficult since 2001 when a state of emergency was imposed and insurgents were labeled as terrorists, and Nepal Army was sent in the field in countering terrorism. Unified Command was composed together with other two security agencies, Nepal Police and Armed Police Forces. Then we started to document a quite high number of cases of enforced disappearances, extrajudicial executions, sexual violence and torture in detentions, among others. UN Working Group on Enforced Involuntary Disappearances back in 2004 came up with the report saying that they recorded the highest number of new cases of disappearances from Nepal. We had you know, UN Office of the High Commissioner's Office being established in Nepal, and it you know, publishes the report called Nepal Conflict Report, documenting more than 30,000 cases of human rights violations. Among them, 2,000 being violations of serious human rights violations and humanitarian law. There were worrying kind of news and information that officers, security personnel involved in making major casualties of those terrorists or the Maoist insurgents being promoted or rewarded by the UN peacekeeping opportunities by sending them to the different UN peacekeeping missions. This was actually corroborated by a number of incidences, number of cases that we have documented. One of such example was the case of Bhairavnath Battalion, one of the battalion from where more than 49 people were disappeared. And the OACHR concluded that Raju Bashnet, Colonel Raju Bashnet, who was the command, being the responsible in most of these cases. He was actually sent to the UN peacekeeping missions in Burundi. Similarly, another very emblematic case is where one of the accused against whom there was a pending arrest warrant called Major Niranjan Bashnet, who was also sent to the UN peacekeeping missions in Chad. When we made this known to the UN, he was repatriated to the country back in 2009. Despite the court orders, he is still not been arrested and moved to the justice. Similarly, there has been a number of other cases where UN has repatriated the personnel from Nepal. The other example was the Deputy Superintendent of Police, Bashant Kumar, who was sent to UN peacekeeping mission in Liberia, despite the pending cases against him in the District Court of Nepal on allegations of torture. You may also have heard this case of Kumar Lama, who is now arrested by the UK police under universal jurisdictions for his involvement in alleged cases of torture in Nepal back in 2005. Was also serving as the expert in the UN missions in South Sudan. So some of these cases actually raised quite serious concerns how those peacekeepers are actually selected. And it also raises the questions of the integrity of the whole peacekeeping missions, and also it negatively impacts the image of the UN and the troop contributing countries. These were cases where media reported quite widely back in Nepal. Even during the course of our consultations in this research process, a number of high-ranking security officials highlighted the fear of the screening of the peacekeeping in the peacekeeping missions. I think this has contributed very positively in terms of preventing torture, illegal detention in Nepal, and other human rights violations. The fear of being not able to be selected for the UN peacekeeping missions for the conduct that they do is really positively contributing in promoting human rights in Nepal. So we are basically advocating that it is important to really have the screening of the peacekeepers in terms of preventing human rights violations in peace missions and also on the ground. Of course, we also acknowledge difficulties. We acknowledge the challenges in terms of having a sort of database of soldiers or the officials or the security personnel involved in human rights violations. But on the ground, we really see it's been not that difficult if we really have a sort of system in place to really check into the reports of the human rights institutions as National Human Rights Commissions, records from the courts or the reports from different commissions of inquiries, and including the one from the different UN bodies and UN mechanisms. Especially in the cases of Nepal, there is a huge database already prepared by the Office of the High Commissioners available publicly. So in some of the cases that I referred where the peacekeepers who were sent for the UN peacekeeping missions were involved in serious human rights violations. One of those cases was this case of this 15-year-old girl who was arrested, illegally detained, disappeared, and later on found tortured to death. Was actually happening in the place where troops are actually trained for the UN peacekeeping missions. It was the training center for the UN peacekeeping peacekeepers. So these are also some of the cases where OSHHRs repeatedly asked government of Nepal to have investigations and prosecutions prior to the incidences where we found them being ending up as the peacekeepers. I think these have been contributed quite negatively in terms of questioning the whole integrity of the peacekeeping missions. As an effort, with these kind of examples, we are we have been having discussions, and we have been having a sort of debate how best to have a sort of this policies in place to prevent these kind of people, perpetrators of human rights violations, ending up in the UN peacekeeping missions. We are very happy that there is this human rights screening policies in place now. So we really like to see this being implemented on the ground. It makes troop contributing countries responsible for screening those soldiers, before sending them to any peacekeeping missions. The troop contributing country has to ensure that they don't have any human rights violations record. And during the research, we have actually gone through the different policies, legal framework that we have in terms of selections of these UN peacekeeping mission, peacekeepers. And we have identified number of gaps there. There are issues of transparencies. No one really knows how they are selected. There are issues of corruption. There are issues of, you know, number of other things, including nepotism and things like that. So other colleagues will tell us in detail how this really happens on the ground. But we really believe that, you know, having further discussions on the issues of best implementations of the screening policies would really positively contribute in preventing human rights violations, not only during the missions, but also in the troop contributing countries. I would stop there, so I'll come back.
Yes, and we'll leave some time for discussion at the end. Thank you so much, Mandira. Now I'll turn it over to Suez.
Thank you, Chair. I think first of all, I think we do recognize the role of the peacekeepers in establishing peace in a number of countries where it's desperately needed. So these reports are not in any way to undermine the efforts of the peacekeepers. But at the same time, the fact that they serve on behalf of the United Nations, obviously they are required to comply with certain standards which are expected from them. That's one aspect. The second aspect is, of course, they are actually the ambassadors of their own countries to the other countries. So in that sense, I think the country itself has certain interest that the people who are selected actually meet the minimum criteria, if not the maximum criteria, in terms of upholding the reputation of the UN as well as their own country. I think what we look at the report of India, basically first of all to examine the India's involvement in peacekeeping operations, it's nothing new. I think India was one of the key actors in the first major peacekeeping operation in DRC in 1961, where lots of actually Indian troops died there for the defense of the United Nations as well as the establishing peace in DRC. So looking at that policy engagement, and I think it still figures within the India's foreign policy with respect to its engagement with Africa. And in fact, peacekeeping is one issue which is referred if you look at the India-Africa summit declaration. So that's one. The second issue which you look at is basically selection of the troops at national level. How does the government of India select for its army, for its paramilitary forces, as well as at the police level? And coming back to that, of course, we do compare how the people who are selected for the UN peacekeeping are actually selected. Then we take up, I think, with respect to India, I think the India's report is more, possibly the most comprehensive, because we had been able to access some of the confidential reports, including from the Office of the Internal Oversight Services of the UN. So two reports, one with respect to the sexual exploitation and abuses conducted by the Indian security forces in the DRC, as well as which the UN termed as the professional misconduct, where the Indian security forces exchanged a number of things with the FDLR, which was one of the forces which was responsible for the Rwanda genocide. Then, and of course, we finally go back to see how the UN actually reacts to all these abuses, which were found by its own internal inquiry, and of course, how the government of India itself has taken action with respect to the demand of the United Nations that there should be accountability both for the sexual abuses and as well as the other misconduct. I think the key finding is that I think India, compared to the other countries, has almost the entire policy and legal framework in place, both in terms of selection for recruitment at national level, as well as sending the troops for the UN duties. But what we found is that though it exists legally, as well as a matter of policy and procedure, obviously there are lots of shortcomings with these policies and practices. And one of the policy which has come out, and which actually the government of India doesn't make it public, but came out in the legal proceedings with respect to a case filed by a peacekeeper who was selected but was not sent for the peacekeeping mission, was that India actually, while selecting the army for the peacekeeping, I mean, then the policy is, I quote, preference to those who have proven themselves while serving in counter-insurgency operations, respect to the army, with respect to the paramilitary forces, it's basically personnel who have served at least 2 years in hard or extreme hard areas like Jammu and Kashmir, Northeast India, Naxal-affected areas. So there is a preference for the government of India as far as selecting the peacekeepers, that those who perform or are posted in the insurgency-affected areas, they will be selected. And of course, you know, I mean, the human rights violations in India, especially in these conflict situations, do not require any introduction. Everybody knows about it. National Human Rights Commission records it, the UN Special Rapporteur, and etc. So there is a huge problem when you incentivize performance in conflict-affected areas for being posted at the UN, and there were troops who were involved in the India-Pakistan war. Actually, the entire contingent demanded that they should be sent for the UN peacekeeping missions. The entire contingent was sent. So there's a problem with respect to them. Now, of course, that's the policy level with respect to the army, which are selected both in terms of individual officers as well as contingent. The other issue with respect to the police officers are actually required to sit for examination for the UN CPOL, this for the selection assistance and assessment test, which is the ANSAR test. And in the examination which was conducted in 2013, we find the reports, we have mentioned that some of the officials who were selected after passing the examination included one accused in a custodial torture case, one officer who is accused of rape and custodial death, another officer who is accused of kidnapping and extortion, and one police officer, before being selected, actually was arrested at the Delhi International Airport while flying to Manila with 52 live cartridges. He was arrested by the Delhi police. He is facing prosecution, but he qualifies as a UN CPOL officer. Now, of course, they all fill up the P11 form. I think that's where the problem comes. The problem is you are not, you have not been held guilty, so you are innocent until proven guilty. But of course, given the judicial delay which we will have, it will take possibly 20 years by the time they will retire and they will be serving at the United Nations. So even if you conduct the examinations, sit for the examinations in a very fair and transparent manner, there is a huge problem in terms of identifying who are the accused. And when I'm saying this, actually in the report, the names of the individuals, the cases are given once we circulate it after the presentation. So if we select people who are actually have served in counter-insurgency affected areas, it's a problematic. I think one of the officials who served here, I don't want to name the official who is retired now, he said the problem for India and the peacekeeping force, it's basically between peacemaking and peacekeeping. So Indian security forces, we are very good at peacemaking. You go, be in a combat situation, brow with everybody, yes. Then now, of course, you go for peacemaking, peacekeeping. It comes with lots of restriction, which essentially Indian security forces are not trained to do because they have given enormous amount of power to deal with insurgency, including shoot, the right to shoot at anybody by the non-commissioned officers under the Armed Forces Presence Powers. So there's, I think, huge problem with respect to that. And what we found out is that all the troops which we are selected for the DRC, and where the only Indian officer which has been given the highest military gallantry awards, the Paramvir Chakra, for the peacekeeping duties was with respect to DRC in 1961. He fought single-handedly, bare-handed, to defend the UN at that point of time. Now, if we look 40 years down the line, where the DRC still had lots of missions, there are two cases which has come up. One is with respect to the sexual exploitation by the Indian troops, which were posted in Kivu and other provinces. And the second, the cooperation or the illegal engagement between the Indian troops and the FDLR who were posted there. I think what I am trying to highlight is the fact that there are not adequate checks and balances, not only in the selection, but also once you are posted there. I think the first report which came up within the UN system was in 2005 when OIOS actually came out with a report about the sexual exploration of the girls and women in the DRC. And they came up with 8 specific recommendations, which was given to the force commander as well as the contingent commanders. So if India had the contingent commanders, obviously they knew that there was already an investigation by the UN. But in that 2005 report, which is a problem with the UN, they actually didn't name the officials or the police personnel, these peacekeepers, which countries they came from. I would presume that some of the two or three countries, including India, which you have posted there, we are involved in. So in 2005, when this report came out from the OIOS with respect to sexual exploitation, then in 2008, obviously, the 2005 report had no impact. So the OIOS had to start another investigation, this time specifically by the Indian troops. After lots of children with Indian features were born in that province. And the DNA test, which was confirmed by the OIOS, confirmed that they are of the Indian origin or descent. Then, of course, the Secretary General made intervention with respect to it and demanded that, you know, the inquiry be conducted, punishment be given. And after 2 years of delaying, about in 2011 May, the Government of India started a court of inquiry by the military. And this court of inquiry took place in Meerut, which is in Uttar Pradesh of North India. We, as the Center for Asian Studies for Human Rights, we went to the National Human Rights Commission saying that, you know, the court of inquiry should be conducted in DRC itself. Because at the end of the day, the victims cannot testify. I mean, what's the point of having an inquiry? The NHRC dismissed the case. Then I wanted basically the findings of the court of inquiry, and the court of inquiry findings we are not given. Then we file an RTI application under the Right to Information Act, which is Freedom of Information Act. And that information was not denied. But last year, the chief of the army staff, which is General Bikram Singh, he said that actually they had taken action against 3 officials who were involved in the sexual exploitation. But when we sought the final report, which we could get, his junior said that, you know, that inquiry was not complete. It was given to us. So basically, the junior saying the army chief was lying. Then we went to the Central Information Commission. That information was denied. And finally, I think, so in that report, which I was referring to, the deputy force commander was actually General Bikram Singh, who went to become the head of the army chief until a couple of months back, about 1.5 months back. That was an issue when he was being appointed as the chief of the army staff of a public interest litigation before the Supreme Court. And essentially, the government of India lied before the Supreme Court by not giving adequate information with respect to his actual designation and responsibilities. So in a way, to show that General Bikram Singh was actually appointed by the UN, so he had no responsibility with respect to the troop contingent, so he cannot be held responsible. The second report, which I was referring to, is another inquiry which was conducted by the OIOS. We make this report a confidential report by the OIOS, which has never been made public. It's available. Of course, the names, the places, and certain officials are blackened so that we cannot be, you know, I mean, some people could be protected. That's the way we found it. Is that the Indian contingent, which were posted in DRC, with the FDLR, which was involved, as I said, in the Rwanda massacre, they basically purchased counterfeit gold, sold rations to the insurgent groups, whom, against whom they are supposed to protect, and they exchanged arms and ammunition with the insurgent groups. These are the findings of the OIOS. But if actually India were to take actions against its officials, because this is the standard proceeding at the moment, procedure that the national government will take action, I am sure all these army officials, if they did this thing inside the country, they would be charged under the Army Act. And if they found guilty for helping the enemies, they would be even sentenced to that. That's what exactly and precisely they did in that area. So there was no action at the moment, and in both this incident, I think it was the involvement of the General Bikram Singh. Also, what we are trying to say is that there's a need for debate, and the current system of selection of the staff by filling up the P11 form is actually not adequate. We need to go beyond that. If I am to speak as an Indian, of course, you know, I mean, we are shamed by what the peacekeepers do, as much as the government of India. So I think it's in our interest to have a good vetting policy relying on the commitment of the states that they will not tolerate human rights violations by those who basically conduct or discharge their responsibilities as the staff of the United Nations. Thank you.
Thank you, Soas. Now we'll turn to Nigeria and Alaa.
Thank you very much, Jerry. Well, I'm sure for Nigeria, you know, it will sound very interesting to most of you, given the ongoing insurgency and given the kind of allegation against the security forces, you know, against the civilian, you know, population in Nigeria. Well, like other countries have mentioned, you know, Nigeria is one of the major contributing troops countries, and for us, you know, we felt it is important that we start the policy and practices, you know, on, you know, selection process of peacekeepers, because prior to this, you know, research, we realized that there is no really, you know, standard, you know, of selection process. A lot of, you know, corruption are also involved, especially, you know, when we are doing the research, we discover that a lot of allegation of, you know, extortion and, you know, corruption, especially within the police, you know, in terms of the selection process. You virtually, you know, pay your way to get selected. And the most, you know, unfortunate one is, of course, the role that Nigerian Army, you know, had played in the 90s in Liberia, where, you know, cases of human rights abuses, especially, you know, sexual violence against women. A lot of women in Liberia were, you know, impregnated by Nigerian Army, and, you know, not serious action has been taken to, you know, against those people who have, you know, committed that kind of thing. And it is repeating itself now with the insurgency going on in the country, where the army, you know, allegedly, you know, reported to be going to civilian houses to rape, you know, women, you know, and do all sorts of things. You know, we thought it is important that at least we should be able to look at, you know, the process, the selection process, and then, because this has really terribly damaged the reputation, you know, of the country. They have done that not only in Liberia, but also even in Sierra Leone, you know, there is that case. And also, as a result of that, a lot of people are not having really confidence, you know, about the role that the Nigerian Army, you know, is playing, you know. So we thought it is important that we look at how, you know, these issues can be addressed. So the report, you know, provides historical facts and figures, and regarding the Nigerian Army, the influence that they have, because they have ruled the country for over 30 years, obviously they will have tremendous influence on the, you know, way and manner things happen in the country, and of course their engagement in the UN peacekeeping. We have also looked at the research also look at the relevant you know, policy, personal policy, and the cases of these abuses, you know, that both the police and the army were reported to have done. We are concerned that some of those army that are currently perpetrating these, you know, sexual abuses and human rights violation in the name of dealing with insurgency, they may end up also being recruited for peacekeeping, which means that when they go there, they can equally repeat what they have been doing, you know, domestically, which would further damage the reputation of the country. We thought it is important that we look at all this and then, you know, provide, you know, useful suggestion and recommendation for the Nigerian government, so that, you know, its reputation could actually be improved, and by, you know, by extension, you know, Nigerian reputation will be improved, because Nigeria being the largest, you know, or rather the most populous, you know, country in Africa, we used to pride ourselves as the mother of Africa. And if the mother is not really doing the right thing, you know, then there's a problem. We believe that if the Nigerian army are doing the right thing, other countries, you know, in Africa, and in fact, by extension, you know, some part of the world, they will also learn a good lesson. So this research enabled us to discover so many things. You know, there are a lot of abnormalities, which, because of the interest of time, I will not be able to go, you know, in detail. But this, you know, presentation will be available for you. But I just want to highlight some of the key challenges that we have encountered, you know, as a result of this research. We discovered that this issue of lack of transparency in the police dating system. There was a corruption during the recruitment, selection, and the administration of the payment of peacekeepers. Even currently now, some of the security, you know, especially the army, are refusing to engage in dealing with the incidents because of the alleged, you know, non-payment of allowances. And this is also happening even when they are sent to the, you know, UN peacekeeping. We also discovered that there's issue of lack of human rights policy. And that is why they don't really care. They can brutalize and molest anybody because there's no any policy in place that will guide, you know, peacekeepers, both the police and the army. We also discovered that there was inadequate content for pre-redeployment training. There was issue of insufficient mechanism for public input and oversight bodies. And of course, there's a huge gender, you know, discrimination and gap, you know, in this whole process. So far, the oversight institution, they don't seem to also be playing the role that they are supposed to play. So we come up with some number of recommendations which we believe could help to do with the issues of challenges facing the vetting and selection of peacekeepers, you know, from the Nigerian Army and the Nigerian Police. The report also demands prompt development of the national policy on peacekeeping, support operation in line with the 2012 UN policy on the UN policy on human rights screening. Such a policy should detail, among other things, the principal criteria, processes and mechanism for the selection of peacekeeping personnel, as well as create civilian oversight mechanism. Only recently, as we were concluding this research, General Williams, whom I'm happy that he's here, we were talking about the fact that there was no policy on insurgent, counter-insurgent, you know, terrorism in Nigeria, and we've been trying to talk with the Nigerian government to see how such kind of policy can be developed, you know. But, you know, the pillars we are getting, you know, there's too much arrogance. They don't simply want to, you know, admit that those, you know, policies are important or they are not in place. So, but we will continue to discuss with them. So part of the recommendation we, you know, offer to the Nigerian government, you know, as a result of this research, is the development of relevant policies on sexual exploitation and abuse, and the investigation of human rights violation by the Nigerian Army and the Nigerian Police Force. Speedy and full integration of women into the pool of peacekeeping operation in both military and police. Establishment of peacekeeping operation offices in all arms of the Nigerian armed forces. Thorough screening for human rights violation, such a system to monitor, you know, the selection of all, you know, contributor components for the peacekeeping, you know. We believe it is going to help, you know, in terms of bringing some sanity, you know, in the peacekeeping operation. Development of a functional and easy timeline database on the conduct of the members of the armed forces and the police. We also recommend that the involvement of the National Human Rights Commission in debating proposed Nigerian Army and the police, you know, would be also very important. Fast-tracking the establishment of a peacekeeping training institute for the police alongside institutional support would also help. Adequate review of the curriculum of all military and police training institutions with a view to mainstream human rights and gender issue in their programs would also be very, very useful. Strengthening oversight mechanism to ensure transparency and accountability in the payment of peacekeepers, allowances and other things, you know, would also be very, very useful, and it will help to motivate the officers to be able to do, you know, the work they do. Right now, if you are sent to assignment, even if you get killed before you get your entitlement, it's a big problem, you know, because of corruption involved in the process. And I'm sure General Williams would bail me out, you know, here. A lot of army are refusing to, you know, engage in the Boko Haram now because they didn't get paid. And if they get killed, nobody pays compensation, or their families are not being taken care of. So there's no motivation, there's no incentives for them to really do what they're supposed to do. So we in CISLAG, we believe that workable and implementation of this recommendation will help to sanitize the Nigerian army armed forces and the police, as and result in more accountable forces at home and more disciplined and effective forces abroad. Finally, we are really grateful that we are part of this intervention. We believe that this effort will help in the overall addressing of peacekeeping issue. And we really thank Open Society Foundation for this support, and also of course the lead researcher that helped us to carry out this research, Engineer Wazireu, as well as many supports that we got from different people to come up with this research. I want to, because of the interest of time, I want to stop here so that we will allow other people to come in. Thank you.
Thank you, Awa. And now we have one more country presentation. Back to Suas for Bangladesh.
Thank you, Chair. I think in Bangladesh, is in many ways, with respect to selection of the staff of the army at the national level, is almost similar to India. But we have not found any documents where the Bangladesh army has a clear-cut policy as to how they should be selected for the UN peacekeeping operations. But I think Bangladesh is a completely different case from the other three countries. I think it's given the fact that the Bangladesh army had a prominent role. It's always described as power behind the throne in Dhaka. And how much actually UN peacekeeping operations contributing to that, the continuation of the strengthening of the role of the army. I think both for India and Bangladesh, the deployment for the UN operations is a financial incentive. I think I didn't mention in the Delhi High Court case, in fact, Delhi High Court said it's a lifetime opportunity. In Bangladesh, I think if we look at the salary structure, an officer going for the UN peacekeeping operations gets about $2,200 per month against about $200 at the national level, and equivalent for the soldiers, which get about $1,100 at the previous rate in comparison to $100 at the national level. I think this has led to monopolization of the UN peacekeeping postings by the army, and has created enormous amount of problems. I think at any given point of time, if we look at the statistics, approximately between 6 to 7% of the entire Bangladesh army is deployed for the UN peacekeeping operations. And out of these, almost 93% come from the Bangladesh army. The rest are from the police. And because I think the Bangladesh army had monopolized the peacekeeping jobs, it led to a major resentment with the Bangladesh rifles, which are bothering the guards. And that led to a very unfortunate and massive massacre, which is unheard in a civilian in peacetime situation on 25th February 2009, in which 74 army persons, including 57 army officers, which were deployed with the BDR, were actually massacred in the BDR headquarters in Dhaka itself. So it's a huge thing. And the government of Bangladesh actually started an investigation. The committee in its investigation report said one of the purpose for this BDR revolt against the army was, quote, proving Bangladesh to be unfit for working in UN missions and reducing Bangladesh's foreign currency, which comes usually from the UN missions. Now, that issue is still not resolved, because the investigation committee in its report said the UN, quote, the UN has objected to the proposal of the Bangladesh Rifles members being taken to foreign mission, and Bangladesh government has no jurisdictions in this matter. But I think this is not the complete story, because the government of India has been sending its paramilitary forces, including the Border Security Force, which is equivalent of the BDR, for the UN peacekeeping mission. So instead of resolving this problem continues, and maybe there is no immediate threat, but I am sure if this continues as it is, this will create further resentment in the future. And of course, monopolizing it is not without consequences. And the first consequence which we see is, though we know that the Bangladesh Army had intervened at different point of times in history in Bangladesh to take over the power, or at least the civilian forces looking over their soldiers while maintaining the powers. In fact, the deployment in the peacekeeping operations has become the raison d'etre for militarization in the country. So if you look at the statement which was made in 2011 and 2012, when the budget was being placed in the parliament, it led that year in 2011-12, 11% hike in the defense budget. And this 11% had to be increased because the government of Bangladesh decided to buy 44 main battle tanks, 3 armored vehicles, 2 helicopters, 4 UN peacekeeping operations. So in a way, you could see that the UN peacekeeping operations are becoming the reason for militarization, modernization of the army in Bangladesh. The second, I think, important fact is, of course, the country becomes more and more dependent on the UN, because at the moment, almost equivalent of the 1/3 of the Bangladesh defense budget, I think it's about $995 million, comes from the UN. It's not necessarily that defense budget, but I'm saying equivalent of that much money is on as far as the estimates given by the Bangladesh government. And this has to be seen in the context of the Bangladesh Army actually having a say in almost all matters relating to the affairs of Bangladesh. Under the Army Act, the Bangladesh Army can depute officers both for the Bangladesh Navy and the Air Force. And when the Rapid Action Battalion was created in 2004, of course, number of officers actually came only from the Bangladesh Army. And as I said, one of the resentment of the BDR, Bangladesh Rifles, against the Bangladesh Army was the officers going and being posted there. And at the time of the massacre, out of the 446 officers in the BDR in the entire country, 386 officers came from Bangladesh Army. So there was a huge overwhelming presence. And now what we have is essentially Bangladesh Army since 2004 being deployed for essentially civil policing. Civil policing, I mean the Rapid Action Battalion, which is a hybrid force drawn from the Air Force, the Bangladesh Rifles, and the Army, and the police, has enormous amount of army presence. I think when we collected the names, which was available in the website of the RAB, a number of officials in August 2013, out of the 208 officers in the RAB, about 83 were from the army officers. We have given the list as available in the... So you could see that the army is not only for the military purposes, and today actually they are doing day-to-day law enforcement activities all over the country to combat so-called terrorists or the criminals. Now, there's a huge problem with this RAB, the Rapid Action Battalion, because the Rapid Action Battalion has been known for number of human rights violations. It's at the moment not qualified to receive support from the US because of the human rights violations. And in fact, leader of the opposition, Khaled Ajia, of course she was part of the creation of the RAB, she herself went on record to say that RAB should be banned from the UN peacekeeping missions. And out of this, I think you have 1/3 of the Bangladesh Army, because it's a small country, almost deployed in Chittagong tracks, where despite the peace, there are still serious reports of human rights violations. And I think at the young officers level, between major, captain, or below that, it will be hard to find Bangladesh Army officers who either did not serve with the RAB or in the Chittagong tracks. And if we are to look at the statistics, I think when the Bidia massacre, which was very unfortunate, took place. But in the reprisal attacks, about 70 Bidia suspects died in the custody of the Bangladesh Army, and which the Economist says almost certainly murdered. So if we look at the reports of the Adhikar, I mean, since the RAB was created in 2004, January 2004, and June 2013, about 776 persons were killed in crossfire. Crossfire which presupposes an armed encounter with the other side. But surprisingly, in this 776 incidents of crossfire, not a single RAB officer was injured or killed. In fact, 20 RAB officers which were killed and given in the website, 18 of them basically were killed in the Pilkhana massacre, and two died in a road accident. So the whole purpose of the crossfire justification actually doesn't hold out. So this, I think, policy of having lots of security forces in the Bangladesh Army for the UN, I think it's not without consequences. I think the first consequence is, as I said, Bangladesh Army remains the power behind the throne in Dhaka. We have a situation where the current government actually had formed the government before the first vote was cast. Of course, army didn't intervene. Very good. Army was not willing to intervene in 2007 for the fear of being denied the opportunities of, to be deployed with the UN. But that may not necessarily hold all the time, because those who have stake in Bangladesh, in true geopolitical sense, they need not necessarily all the time rely on what the UN says. There would be a time, and there will be a time, that irrespective of whether the Bangladesh Army is deployed for the UN purpose or not, they will still support a particular government, and which need not necessarily be democratic. So finally, I think the key point which I wanted to send wanted to say is that there's a huge challenge when you recruit or take army personnel from a small country, 7% almost all the time, and whether UN, for the sake of establishing peace elsewhere, is actually contributing towards solidifying the role of the army in that country where, you know, there are lots of questions which remain unanswered. And this goes into the very problem which the DPKO and the UN seeks to address, the security sector reform. You cannot have security sector reform if you are indirectly going to solidify the role of the army. I think Bangladesh wants to be a democratic country. It's in the interest of Bangladesh, you know, I mean, to have lesser role, to be more accountable, and lesser role with respect to the politics. And that's not going to happen unless UN, you know, completely reduces its reliance, taking into consideration that you are indirectly interfering in the political affairs of that country, knowingly or unknowingly. Thank you.
Thank you, Suez. So we've covered a lot of ground very quickly, but we have time for discussion, for questions, for comments. I'm going to take the prerogative of the chair and ask the first question, perhaps to you, Suez, just following up on your closing remarks, where you're suggesting that the UN has the leverage over Bangladesh to require changes as a condition for accepting troops. But if you take these four countries that we've looked at, plus Pakistan, Ethiopia, and Rwanda, which are the other major contributors in the top seven, each of whom you could do a similar report on, I think, if the UN said we won't take troops from you until you get your vetting in order, where would that leave the UN in terms of getting the troops that it needs for peacekeeping missions?
I think it's a shared responsibility. You know, there are two aspects into it. I mean, the Bangladeshis, the Indians might as well say, why should our soldiers go and die in DRC? So it's as much as India's responsibility as you say, for example, the United States. And if the United States can send its troop to Afghanistan, why can't it send it to the DRC? I think where the UN needs to have consensus and come around is basically that the member states of the UN should be equally contributing towards the peacekeeping operations rather than exploiting, if I may use the word, you know, I mean, certain countries which are not able to pay and the soldiers are willing to risk their life and die for somebody possibly where they have nothing at stake. So I think the UN needs to move towards having a more cogent response, because unless everybody contributes to it, this problem will continue. And at the end of the day, international peace is shared responsibility.
Did either of you want to comment on that? You don't have to.
I think we, when we were having this discussions, this question keeps coming up, actually, because UN desperately needs troops, and if we really start becoming more demanding on human rights kind of issues, whether we would, UN would get troops, and also this is a voluntary services, you know, offered by the countries. So we see the problem there. On the ground, actually, I don't really see that logic's really working. We don't believe that, for example, in the case of Nepal, every single soldiers are involved in human rights violations. There are just few bad apples. There are few individuals who have been involved in human rights violations. By removing them, having a place, you know, having a system in place to really prevent them to be in the UN peacekeeping mission does not actually prevent entire, troops or entire other community of the security forces in working as the peacekeepers. I think it's really if we are not ready to really take it, then we indirectly are saying that we are ready to take all human rights violators, or we are ready to take even those who are involved in serious human rights violations. I think there's a moral dilemma there, you know. So I think on the ground, we don't really see every single security personnel being involved in human rights violations. There are few individuals, and by having a sort of policy in place and practicing it, I think you would actually contribute significantly even to promote good officers who aspires to serve in the UN peacekeeping missions, having a sort of opportunities. And also contributing to prevent human rights violations on the ground, and also in the troop receiving countries. So I think this fear of not having enough troops because of having human rights, I think checks, is in a way false kind of argument. That's how I see it.
Sorry, just to come in on that. You know, I think one of the major problems that we are facing, you know, is because also the UN has no special, armed personnel that it could deploy. So it will have to rely on these, countries. But I think, even the UN can actually insist that, because they also contribute, their own through in terms of material, support, they also contribute. So they could insist, because the attitude of some of these countries sometimes is such that they would just dismiss everything. For example, when we approached the Nigerian army and asked them to comment on this same report, they wrote back to say that everything, they have everything in place. There's no any problem, and they have taken care of anything, other violation or any possible violation. But in reality, that is not the case. What we are seeing now domestically, is such that there's no such kind of discipline, or oversight, by the military or the police themselves. So it's really a big problem. But I think the UN can insist on a minimum standard, which the country, that are contributing to the troops must comply with, And I think, countries are also, taking pride that they're contributing to the UN. And I'm sure Nigerian personnel too. They are happy to be, you know, named that they have gone to the UN to do this and do that. And in fact, they are even proud that they are actually going to other countries to, you know, help restore peace. But apparently, back at home, I'm sure you all know what is going on. You know, over 200 girls have been kidnapped. There's no indication that they are going to do anything. We met the army at a high level, and what they told us was such a revealing, you know, thing. You know, so there are a lot of issues, and I think the UN can play a role to ensure at least minimum standard is complied with.
Thank you. So may I open it up? Yes.
Okay. Hi. I wonder if any of you can give examples from your home countries where a UN peacekeeper accused of human rights abuses was tried and prosecuted in a court of law.
As I had mentioned, certain Indian troops belonging to the 6th Sikh Regiment, who were posted in the DRC, they were accused of sexual violations. And the military has conducted the court of inquiry. And as far as the Army Chief of Staff is concerned, who has just retired, General Vikram Singh, that they found 3 officials guilty. But we have not been able to find out the exact proceedings because they were denied under the Right to Information Act also. So there are cases of this nature, at least in India, where you would say that, you know, Court of Inquiry, it's basically tried under the Military Act. So some trial in a case where they could no longer hide it, they had to do it. So in the report, the proceedings are mentioned. We could provide that.
Either of you two?
I think in the context of Nepal, we have the same problem as Shu has mentioned. There were allegations of peacekeepers from Nepal being involved in sexual abuse in the missions. They were sent back to face the trial. They were never tried in civilian jurisdictions. We were told that they were tried in, they were court-martialed. But no one actually knows whether there was any court-martial or not, because all the information regarding the court-martials and court of inquiries are extremely confidential. So we actually don't know whether court-martial actually took place in those cases. And one of the recommendations that we have been making is that those who are involved in sexual violence and sexual abuse in the missions should be tried in civilian courts, which has not been the case so far.
Yeah, well, not necessarily on the sexual, you know, abuses, but when the soldiers, they protested of non-payment of their allowances, you know, they were court-martialed, and though eventually, you know, they were not killed, you know, but, you know, they were, you know, sacked. So maybe perhaps the sexual violence is not, you know, that much interested, you know, to the authority. But they are more concerned with their reputation, that some of the army are disgracing them for not payment, you know, for not collecting their own allowances. So they were more interested in that than maybe perhaps punishing and dealing with those people that are engaged in brutal violation of people's rights.
So I think maybe I'll take a couple of questions.
Yeah, my name is Akhtar. I'm from Bangladesh Mission. Thank you very much for inviting us for this report launching seminar and then informing us with the certain details. If I may be allowed to respond some of the comments as put by Mr. Suhas. In regards to our case, we maintain, my government maintains zero tolerance on the sexual abuse cases and other discipline issues. In a mission, if someone is found guilty of or with the offense of this C cases, he will be repatriated then and there at his own cost, at his own cost, I repeat. So he'll not be even given with the air transportation. Regarding selection procedures, I would request that you should have a fair idea as to how selection is made as per the requirement of the UN. question of monopolization by army is absolutely, I think, flawed and doesn't make any sense, because the country doesn't have, or the organization doesn't have much freedom in terms of selection. Means army cannot replace others. Say in our case, army has the different branches, and the participation percentage also varies, because is based on the UN requirement. Likewise, the Air Force and Navy contribution is much less, particularly Navy, because they cannot fulfill the role of the infantry. So we provide peacekeepers as per the UN requirement, like infantry battalion, engineers, or the aviation unit, whatever is asked for by the UN. So question of monopolization by the Bangladesh Army is really not true in any way. However, as you mentioned about the participation of BGB now, the Border Guard Bangladesh, so that's, they really don't qualify to be a peacekeepers. Our government would be happy if they really qualify to be taken as peacekeepers. That's the UN procedures. And some of the perceived army's role or have been expressed, I think we have quite preservation in that. That really undermines us. So you can't really have those sort of assumptions that they will, what they would be doing in the future power politics and all this, once we have all full respect for the democratic practices. Finally, I have a serious reservation on the caption really put in the beginning, like sending death squads to the peacekeepers. It's like we are watching a movie or something like that. That really undermines not only our peacekeeping history of last two decades or so, but also 112 peacekeepers, those who have made supreme sacrifices. This really, I have a serious reservation on this. I would request the OSF in particular, please, this also. Thank you, sir.
So I'll take a couple more comments and then, or questions. Yes, sir.
Sanjay Patel from the Public Health Program here at OSF. One comment, one question. Picking up on Awal's comment about minimum standards, I mean, going back also to Jerry, you're sort of implicit in your question about the increase in missions requiring greater personnel and the decrease of contributions from North-based countries. I think that part of the problem is the DPKO and the UN, actually, that the reason they're hesitant to actually enact minimum standards is because when political decisions are made to actually deploy peacekeepers, they need to fill those warm bodies, and they don't want minimum standards because that would compromise their ability to actually meet the requirements. And I think that's a problem. You see it in Haiti, for example. The cone of silence that descended after the Nepalese peacekeepers were said to have brought cholera to Haiti. Like, there's been no transparency from the UN on this question. And I think, I mean, even the irrational decisions, I mean, in Bangladesh, there's a real issue of a lack of women police officers. And, you know, with the mission in Haiti, 300 women peacekeepers were sent from Bangladesh to Haiti when Bangladesh actually needs these women police officers. These women police officers don't speak any Creole or French. And, I mean, it just, the irrational decisions that emanate from the DPKO is part of the problem, in my opinion. The question I have is linking back to the points raised about extortion and the pecuniary benefit that come with serving as peacekeepers. We know in the countries that have been profiled today that issues of patronage and corruption are real issues that prevent the professionalization of police within the region. Of South Asia particularly, but I suspect it's true also of Nigeria. To what extent is this system of peacekeepers going abroad and making really good money a impediment to actually reform of policing systems domestically, or is it just a symptom of a deeper malaise? So I guess because there are senior officers that go for this and really rely on the foreign income that come in, is this actually big enough of an issue that it serves as an impediment to genuine police reform in these various countries?
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
There are two sets of violations actually at stake. The violations committed by the individuals who have a record either of criminal conduct or of IHL or IHRL violations, but then there's also the violation of the government's obligation to pursue investigation and where bona fide the substantiation of the allegation is made, continuing on to prosecution. Thus far, the UN, for obvious reasons, has refrained from naming and shaming either the individuals by name or by nationality, or the countries who have failed to live up to their obligations under their memorandum understanding with the UN to prosecute the individuals concerned. In your view, would such naming and shaming help efforts to ensure that this criminality is prevented? Or will it just have the expected result of making it more difficult for the UN to obtain true contributions from the countries concerned?
So I'll let you respond to those, and then we should have time for one more round.
I think with respect to the Bangladesh border guards, as I said, the Indian border security forces, which are equivalent of the Bangladesh Rifles, they have been serving in Haiti, Kosovo, and Liberia. So at some stage, I think you would like to know why the border guards in India are actually qualified to be selected for the UN operations, and the same border guards just across the border in Bangladesh are not qualified. What prevents the, there's serious dichotomy, because if India is sending, we have given the footnote that the BSF is in Haiti, Kosovo, and Liberia, then why the border guards of Bangladesh cannot go there? With respect to the whether the deployment in the UN is an impediment to police reform, I think it's very difficult to say, because there are not that many police officers which are going for the UN peacekeeping operation than the civil police officers. But surely, I think not only police reform, but I think the whole accountability regime which exists in these South Asian countries or other countries which are primarily contributing for the UN, it remains a problem. It remains a problem, as I said. People who are charged with serious criminal offenses in India, carrying live cartridges, 52 of them, inside the aircraft in Delhi, you are arrested, charged, and you still qualify because you have not been found guilty. So there's a serious problem. I think the last issue with respect to naming and shaming, I think naming and shaming will actually help both the country and the UN, because we are not looking at the UN to prosecute these officials. But surely, I think if you know the names of officials, at the national level, the own mechanism takes place. For example, with respect to some of the prosecutions which the Indian Army was forced to do, it's thanks to the pressure from the NGOs, women rights groups, and the media covering the conduct of the Indian forces, going all the way to the DRC to report, take the photographs of the children who were born with Indian features. It creates tremendous amount of pressure. So unless and until you name and shame them, it becomes very difficult to establish accountability. Once you name them, and I'm sure each country has its own mechanism to establish accountability. I think, as Madhira said, the accusation is not against all the security forces. There are patterns or incidents where the country concerned, including Bangladesh, have taken prompt action. But until and unless the state recognizes, why should the state, what's the interest to protect the name of a criminal? At the end of the day, he's not representing the country if he's a criminal any longer. So, there is no way, you should hide the name. I think that's biggest problem, of course, as I said, for the names to come out from the UN. In fact, UN becomes almost the most secretive organization in terms of getting access to information. And that's a big problem.
Yeah, well, for us, we think if there's a strong mechanism to oversight the conduct of the personnel, I think even the question of naming and shaming will not have been come, because you would have a very strong standards and procedure And if you violate those standards, then you know the consequences as an officer. But because I think it has not also been seen as a major serious offense, that's why, you know, till today, those who have impregnated those women in Liberia, Sierra Leone, you know, no any punishment really has been made to them. And, you know, we have had cases where many of these women had to come down to Nigeria looking for those guys, you know. But it's like it's normal, you know. It's like normal. It's not taken really as a serious offense until we begin to know to do advocacy and to insist that, you know, such is a serious offense and is, you know, bringing back the reputation of the country down. So maybe then we can now begin to see, you know, action taking place, you know. But the UN might not necessarily be effective if the internal, you know, or if the national government is not able to have mechanism in place to checkmate those abuses, you know. I think, you know, the UN might not that be that much effective. I think we need national pressure from the civil society and from the media who covers, you know, the activities of the military, you know, and the police, you know, while, you know, in service. I think that might be more effective and efficient. Otherwise, you know, I don't really see how even the naming and shaming by the UN would be effective, you know, on individual personnel. And I also agree that it's not all the army, I mean, it's not all the security people that are involved in these abuses, you know. I think it's just some of them that they cannot hold themselves and respect the institution.
Very briefly, the some of the problems that we have highlighted are not actually limited to these four countries. Actually, many of those two contributing countries do have similar kind of challenges and problems. We have to thank the civil society initiatives and other actors, and also democratic space that is available in these, at least in these four true contributing countries, where we could conduct this research and have this kind of debate and discussions. This is not actually possible in many other countries. So UN has already adopted the policy. I think December 2012's human rights screening policy exists now. It is a public document. It requires certain things to be fulfilled by the true contributing countries as well as the UN. I think if these policies are put in place or monitored, the effective implementations of this would actually contribute in win-win kind of situations. It really improves the integrity of the peacekeeping missions. It improves the image of the UN and true contributing countries, and it contributes significantly in strengthening the rule of law and human rights on the ground. You know, when you rely on national human rights institutions, you know, in terms of information, you actually ask security personnel to cooperate with these national human rights institutions in their investigations, for example. When you rely on the courts, you really strengthen the judicial system on the ground. So there are actually a number of benefits that we could see. So we see this as a leverage. You know, we don't really see this as a threat. It's a leverage if we really use it in such a way that actually paves way for the wider security sector reforms and democratic kind of space being opening in number of these two contributing countries as well. So this is how we really look into this.
Thank you. So I think we can squeeze in, if you're very quick, a couple more. I want one round. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I'm Mari. Mari Turi from the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights at the UN, and I really appreciate the opportunity and the research. And I want to make one comment and one quick question. So short comment. So you've spoken about the screening policy, and indeed I align myself exactly with what Mandira said now. The idea behind the screening policy is to make a change, both for the credibility and efficiency of peacekeeping operations, but at the same time to ensure that those who contribute to these operations make the necessary changes to address impunity and to bring their best people to these operations in order to be efficient, to protect credibility, everything, all the practical arguments as well as the legal arguments. And I think that the fact that the screening policy puts in requires an individual to sign an attestation, but also requires the government to sign an attestation for the troops they're putting forward, that presumes that there should be a serious process at national level before that certification is done. Now, if that's not the case, then clearly I think these studies have shown that that needs to be done and that must be in place in order for this certification coming from governments to be credible. And the UN does proactive screening under the policy, but only for the top-level positions, whether civilian or military, so force commanders, deputy force commanders, SRHDs, because we simply don't have the resources to do the kind of investigations that are required. Also, the policy doesn't require a judicial investigation by the UN. But that should be done at national level. And so if the policy can affect change, like you said, at national level, that would be one major objective achieved. The second is we should also think whether, for example, on the African continent, the AU, we should lobby for them to adopt similar policies because peacekeeping is becoming more an African in the African context. So that's one. And my question to you was really, but as you did the research, did you find any country where there were good precedents in place at national level for selecting people for service in peacekeeping operations? Because that would be interesting to look at, obviously, as well. Thanks.
Yes, my name is Eiko Ikigai. I'm from the Department of Peacekeeping Operations, and I just wanted to quickly follow up on what Marit mentioned, also on the human rights screening policy. Wanted to reiterate and emphasize that from the DPKO perspective, it is an issue that we have been taking quite seriously. One clarification is that the human rights screening policy actually applies to all UN personnel, not just peacekeepers. So it's any kind of any category of UN personnel. But at the same time, the genesis of the policy was indeed these concerns about the conduct of UN peacekeepers. So it has taken quite a long time to develop the policy. It was a system-wide effort, but DPKO and also the Department of Field Support were seriously engaged in the development of the policy. Another quick clarification is that the policy takes a three-pronged approach. One is member state responsibility, and this is where there's a screening and sort of a certification that's required from the government in terms of the personnel that they put forward. The second part is the individuals who serve at the UN do sign individual attestations. And then the third part is the UN Secretariat then is making a further effort for proactive screening, which currently at the time is limited to the senior level. So there are these three different levels of activities that are going on. And in the year and a half that the policy has been in place, the different parts of the UN system are coming together to look at the implementation of the policy and see if there are areas where we can improve. But as far as troop contribution is concerned, obviously we are dependent on the member states for at the national level to take action to comply with this policy. But I just wanted to emphasize again that this is something that as the department, DPKO takes quite seriously. Yes, there is always a need for force generation. There's always a need for quick deployment, and there are serious efforts for expanding the base for troop contribution, but I wanted to make sure that it was clear that the human rights screening policy is something that is taken quite seriously in the department.
Is there, yes.
I was just curious about the location of the missions, the country governments. What is their contribution, or what is their involvement in such situations that occur by the peacekeepers that are there? Does the government have any kind of contribution towards protecting its citizens, and what has happened, as a result of that, if at all?
Sorry, you mean the governments of the troop receiving countries?
So, for example, when peacekeepers are in Liberia and they're committing such atrocities, what responsibility does the government of Liberia have, towards its people in protecting its people? So, Nigeria can call back their troops and prosecute. But what does Liberia do to protect its citizenship? And then my other thought is, in terms of UN having different standard policies, member countries are the ones that fund the UN. So if they have their own process and procedures of selecting, realistically, how much power does the UN have to dictate how these peacekeepers are selected or have any impact as to how these peacekeepers are selected, if member countries are the ones that are, you know, funding the UN and contributing towards, you know, the UN.
Thank you. Hey, so
there's two more.
Okay, very quickly.
Yeah, I just want to say
we've got lunch set up, so.
I just want to look at it from a military point of view, because I'm a retired soldier. First and foremost, you know, if the military is perfect, there will be no need for military police. Okay? And therefore, if UN wants to take up that particular issue, what UN needs to do is to create an independent military police force, different from the countries that are contributing troops, who can then be responsible for enforcement of whatever standards and conditions that US have put in place. And once the soldier is arrested, he can be kept in the guard room of his country and deported. Okay, that's number one. Number two, we need to differentiate between peacekeeping and stability operations. Look at the case of DRC. UN had been in DRC for 50 years, peacekeeping. What peace are you keeping for 50 years, for God's sake? And you are fighting counterinsurgency in the name of peacekeeping. And if there's international humanitarian law that soldiers have been taught, then it's different from peacekeeping. And therefore, the conditions are not the same, not the same context. Mr. Sharma has mentioned something that is very important: security sector reform and democratic control of the armed forces. A lot of money has been spent from Africa, where I come from. And one of the key elements has been human rights training for soldiers under the democratic control of the armed forces and security sector reform. And of course, the case of women in peacekeeping or in the armed forces. These are all issues, maybe with new dimension and new perspective. So what we need to do is to be creative about having an institutional approach into how we can resolve those issues. And I don't think they are so complex at all. There's no time to discuss that anyway.
We'll have another session to cover those. And Ingrid, a very quick remark.
Yeah, I wanted to pick up on the comment that, or question that was made about naming and shaming. I would hope that as we go forward with implementation of the policy, that a point may come in time where the UN, through whatever precise process, would be able to name those countries where it feels this UN screening policy is not really being implemented.
Very good. And then I'll let the panel have the last word. Why don't we start with you, Awal, and work our way down?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, it's becoming very increasingly clear that, you know, we need to have, you know, these policies and practice, you know, in place and improve, you know. We were very disappointed that, you know, when we sent our draft report to the Nigerian Army to make comment, and the response we got, you know, which if you have available, if you have this document, you will see. Clearly, you know, they insist that they have everything in place, yet the violation, you know, continues to happen every now and then, and no any major is taken to do with that, which means that, you know, even if they have the document in place, it's not being practiced, and nobody will try to access this document. It's not accessible. It's not a public document at all. So I think, you know, it is important that, you know, agency responsible for ensuring that, you know, this, you know, practice, you know, is actually enhanced and improved, especially the selection process where corruption is marred, you know, into it, you know. I think, you know, it's to be very, very, you know, important that the civil society and the media continue to work. And I think for the UN, I think they should not just do as if, you know, they are not concerned, you know, because they are not having their own army. I think they should be concerned, because invariably, if this violation happens, people will also link it to the inability of the UN to take more proactive to protect the, you know, lives and the, I mean, life of the people. I think it is important that the UN become more active and passionate about the way and manner in which these people are actually doing their things. So let them not be seeing it from the far away. You know, I think also it is important that they begin to now work closely with civil society to monitor these abuses. As it is now, I don't think that, you know, relationship is very, you know, much in place. I think you need to, you know, the DPQR, they need to look at possibility of working closely with civil society and the media to ensure that there's a compliance, you know, of the standard that is being put in place.
Thank you. Andrea?
Well, I remember like a couple of years ago, this was a subject which no one really wanted to discuss, debate on. It was very sensitive within UN, in the country context as well. But now we are, I think, in the process, and we have already have sort of policies in place at UN levels. And back home, we have been able to have some discussions. Someone had to begin from somewhere. You know, initially it was very difficult, I think, for many of us to really, you know, have any discussions on these issues. But I think discussion has started. Debate has started that has actually contributed in a number of these countries to have certain policies reformed on the ground. You know, in the context of Nepal, there was this policy drafted in 2008, which was kept confidential. You know, it was a sort of selection process. You know, it would detail out how, you know, peacekeepers had to be selected, but it was kept completely confidential. Now, recently, in 2013, we have another policy. So we revisit 2008 policy, 2013 policy is accessible to public. You know, it is transparent. You know, it is there online, so you could actually comment, go through it, review it, and identify the gaps. I think it's possible. It's possible to have a sort of discussions and use this as a leverage in really, you know, push for reforms at the national level in, I think, promoting rule of law, human rights, and also prevent human rights violations in two preserving countries, which is the major concerns in many you know, agencies you know, present here today. So I think we have actually moved, you know, from this kind of taboo kind of issues to a kind of issues that needs some debates and discussions, which I think is a positive kind of state.
Thank you. And so us very quickly to wrap up.
I think, I mean, there are no good best practices, but I think the country itself still gives preference to officials who are supposed to have performed exceedingly well for selecting the UN peacekeepers. Obviously, there is a need for a review of that national policy because, as I said, you know, some of the people who were selected, they were selected for devious records. So that's one aspect. The second issue is, what is the action or the responsibility of the troop recipient country? I think when the Indian troops were forced to withdraw in March 2009 from DRC after they were found guilty of, UN basically has asked them to withdraw, then India immediately decided they will send about 200 Indian Air Force personnel there. The response of Joseph Kabila, President Kabila, was saying, no, we don't want this, more of the same troops. And at that point of time, the government of India basically said, we will withdraw the entire troops. And if India had withdrawn the entire troops, then of course the entire peacekeeping mission itself would have collapsed. In fact, thereafter, then the foreign minister of the DRC had to write a letter to the Indian government saying, you are most welcome. So the troop, the recipient countries, they are already extremely vulnerable. And I don't think they are in a position to defend the rights of the citizens. And because they have basically no jurisdiction, or basically the edifice of the state structure doesn't exist. So that's why you have the UN coming there. And the final point is, of course, can the UN dictate? Obviously, you know, I mean, the Secretariat can't dictate. But the fact that, you know, there is more engagement today, as Madhira had said, or debate on this whole issue, I think, I mean, it's a good beginning after 60 years. Now, I'm sure in the next 20 years' time, we could be making a bit more progress than what it is today.
Maybe 20 years, or maybe shorter than that. You know. to be in this business, I found you have to take the long view sometimes.
Yes.
So with that, I thank all of you for coming, and please join me in thanking our panelists.